All right, and we are here on the Duluth Rundown podcast. Today's episode, we're really going to talk kind of specifically about one specific thing. We're going to talk about the Arrowhead 135. We're joined here today with three people who have completed the race. Dave Schuneman, Jeremy Kershaw, and Jason Buffington. Guys, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Thank you.
I want to start, we'll go around and introduce yourselves, number one, just so people who are listening can get a sense of the name that will relate to the voice when they're hearing this later on. And when you do, state your name and how many starts you have and how many finishes you have at Arrowhead, because sometimes those are different numbers.
I'm curious, too, like what discipline as well. So
Yeah, we'll get to that for sure. Yeah.
All right, my name is Dave Schuneman. I've started once and finished once on foot 2 years ago.
I'm Jeremy Kershaw. I think I've got seventh start, I've got five finishes, and we'll get to those disciplines, but I've done it in every category so far.
And I'm Jason Buffington. I have eight starts and six finishes.
Nice. And for the Atois, for the listeners who don't know, the Atois is doing the Arrowhead, I should explain. It's a 135-mile winter race up in International Falls. You can do it three different ways in three different disciplines, either on foot, ski, or bike. And if you do all three over the course of however many years it takes you to get it, you get a special award called the Atois. And two of you guys have received that, right?
Right. Correct.
So you're... That,
I'm going for the that. Double Atois. I'm not sure what that is in French.
There you go. Yeah.
The deux Atois.
Yeah, exactly. Atois squared. And Dave, you might be going for yours eventually. That's the ultimate plan.
Yeah, that's the motivation for sure.
Yeah, very cool.
But you didn't mention the one key part of Arrowhead, in that it's in the most brutal part of winter, end of January, and that's kind of the main component of it. Right?
That's kind of what Arrowhead is famous for, obviously, is the weather conditions as much as anything. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, too. A question that I have for you guys, going back to when you first heard about Arrowhead, when was it that you first heard about it, and what were your thoughts? Did it right away you said, I'm going to do that, or holy cow, that sounds tough?
Probably heard about it pretty much a decade ago, I'd say. And no, I didn't want to sign up immediately. I was really intrigued, but I definitely took a step back and realized I'm not prepared. I want to talk to a lot of people. I think these two guys are already doing them. And I had inspiration from them. And but it wasn't immediate.
I had a friend, kind of a mentor of mine at the time, Laura Sullivan, who lives in Ely now. And she was doing it on foot at that time. And this was right at the kind of the advent of Pugsley's coming on to the scene with maybe a 3 to 4 inch tire maybe then. That was a big deal. But when I first heard about it, I'm like, well, of course you got to ski it. There's no other way to do it. And so there was no question. And then she really, she's been kind of an inspiration of mine in a lot of ways, but just finishing it was what we'd say in my eyes was winning it. So there was no first, second, or third or anything. It was just completing it was the carrot. And so it quickly lodged in my brain, and I think I registered that first time that I heard about it, and I've learned a lot since.
Yeah, I moved back to Duluth in 2001 and started doing a little mountain biking and a little running and just kind of getting into the outdoor scene. A few years after that, my kids were young, and we enrolled them in kid ski up at Snowflake. And I remember a guy up there that had his bike on the top of his car all the time at Snowflake, and got to talk to him, and turned out to be Charlie Farrow, and was talking about this race up in International Falls in the middle of the winter and riding his bike, and I thought he was kind of nuts at the time. Over the next couple of years, started talking to Charlie a little bit more, and then I met Jeremy and another guy, Tim Eck, from town, and kind of went from being what's called the, I used to do the short and fat mountain bike over in Squamigan, and do Grandma's Marathon or Half Marathon every year, and I was just starting to ski a little bit, and then when I met Jeremy and Tim Eck and Charlie Farrell, over the next couple of years, this is probably about in 2009 and 10, and then I think it was 2010 that first signed up for the Arrowhead. So it was first Charlie Farrell, probably a couple of years before that, and then we kind of all got together in about 2010.
Nice.
Faro is kind of a gateway drug for a lot of people in the endurance world. It's someone your parents should tell you to stay away from. And he was also a person that was pretty important in getting into this whole part of going long on whatever discipline. His was certainly cycling, but it was he's a guy that your parents warn you about. So
it's funny.
So speaking of Charlie, and he's not here, so it's kind of unfair to ask, but do you guys know, did he do the first one by any chance?
I don't remember. He and another guy named either. Dave Preyman were kind of, those guys were really, really fast riders at the time, and they're very strong still. I don't recall, but I think he was right up there in the sharp end of that starting. Yeah. If it wasn't the first, it was the second, yeah.
One thing I like about Arrowhead is the on their website, the Arrowhead, I think it's arrowheadultra.com maybe, something like that. Anyway, there's so many blog posts. Mm-hmm. So you can go back years and years and years and read people's kind of race reports and things, and it's so much fun. You can spend hours doing that, which I've done. Because it's part of your prep, I think, for training for Arrowhead is to read all of everybody's blog posts. But I think that's a cool aspect of the race.
Yeah, it seems to me that he got in on the second one. And because up until a couple of years ago, I think he had finished every single one of them except for the very first one. He had the most finishes.
Yeah, nice.
That was, you know, as an aside to a real quick one, that when I first got into gravel cycling, you know, it was this weird world of 40 to 50 year old guys writing on blogs, which to me was kind of a weird revelation. And there are these crazy stories, you know, and I hate to say kind of old, but it was back in the day when finishing Arrowhead was a total question mark. I mean, you were bivvying out, even the fastest writers were these harrowing stories. And so Faro and Preyman, these other people that were writing about it, it really sparked the imagination in a way that is maybe different than it is now because the times now are so fast. And I'm still waiting for a really bad, you know, weather year again, and it will slow people down again. But yeah, that was definitely part of the mystique.
Yeah, I think Arrowhead pre-fat bike is a whole different ball game than Arrowhead post-fat bike.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, you were almost guaranteed to push your bike at least 20 or 30 miles, I think, at that time.
And now the guys just hammer. It's crazy how fast they ride.
If the finish was like a coin flip, you know, what's changed? Is it the crop of athletes? Is it the equipment? Is it just the getting lucky with weather?
A little bit of a little bit of both, I'd say. I mean, the technology and your equipment has come so far. And then just, I mean, all the way, like Tony said, beginning with reading blogs, I mean, your knowledge base going in is so much more, too. I mean, you won't make the same mistakes because there's been so many that has made those before you, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Definitely the biking realm, the technology, you know, going fat bike and bigger tires, lighter bikes is huge. You know, for the other two, not as much. But definitely it's the caliber of athlete, I think, you know, especially for skiing and running, and but even the biking. You know, the first couple of years, it was just the people that were crazy enough to be out there for a couple of days. But now you get the, you know, McFadden's and Wakeley's, and I mean, these guys are just pushing it. I mean, some huge athletes.
Yeah, for some folks, kind of that winter ultra, that's their specialty. That's their deal. Yeah. And they'll kind of travel all over the country for these things. And
Yeah.
I mean, it's undisputable that the popularity has grown quite a bit, I think, with the winter ultras in general, but especially the prestige and just notoriety of Arrowhead. Is that good or bad? Or, I mean, does that take away from kind of the, you know, this is coming from me. I'm the only person who hasn't started or finished Arrowhead, but, you know, it seems like this kind of like grassroots event, which makes it cool, you know. And do you think the popularity of winter ultras in general takes away from that? It makes it better?
I think it only makes it better. I don't think you can really saturate endurance. I mean, you know, Arrowhead and events like it are kind of, there's a lot of creativity that comes with it, you know, and even outside of the events, it kind of spurs ideas when you're on your own. I wouldn't say it takes away, detracts from the summer. I mean, people do both, and you can pick which is your cup of tea, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, I can say it personally detracts from me because I'm an old slow guy and these young fast guys. But overall, I think it's great for, you know, all the races. And yeah,
I find it scary to call Buffington old and slow, but I don't think it detracts either, because like Dave said, there was a ton of creativity that still goes into it. I am distracted by some of the really, really fast people. But when it comes down to it and you get to the start line, it doesn't matter. You go quickly into your own world and you cope with whatever the conditions are, however you're feeling at the time. And it becomes very individual. And it doesn't, everything that goes before, you know, all the hype or all the stories or whatever, kind of disappears and you focus. So, and there's just not many multi-day, at least for the skier runner, winter events out there. In fact, I could name it maybe just on one hand. So, yeah, I mean, there's more racers, and the caliber, the strength of the racer has gone up, but it's still at its roots, you know, a bunch of kind of weirdos getting together and going hard for a couple of days. So,
especially when you get into the race itself and things start to string out and all of a sudden you're on your own in the middle of the woods, that's when everything is all entirely different out there. And that's when, like, to me, like, the beauty of Arrowhead starts to kick in.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's so serene out there.
You certainly have to be okay with being by yourself for a good number of hours. And I think a lot of people that do it are, but that is one of the, I know that course, I feel like in my, you know, it's just ingrained in my brain, but it's still great to be out by yourself. It's one of the best parts about that event to me.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Do you see a lot of people? And that's coming from me is, and I think a lot of our listeners, this is totally something out of this world, you know? And so I'm curious, like, do you see a lot of other athletes? Do you see a lot of other snowmobilers or like staff people? Or is it just like this oasis of the three aid stations and like that's your only, you know, contact with other people?
You may or may not. I guess it's just luck if you happen to be paced the same as another athlete around you. And I don't know, from the only time I've been out there, I realized it probably wasn't, or it isn't best to do that, because you can, you know, their pace can cause mistakes in you coming that you don't see down the way. And but yeah, you see the occasional snowmobile. There's a couple welfare checkers out there on snowmobiles involved with the race, and then other, you know, they don't close the trail. I mean, anyone can go out and ride still. And
right.
But yeah, it's just, you never know. I mean, you can have a stretch of really desolate time alone, and then you can just somehow, you know, come into a hut where someone's, you know, boiling water and taking a break and eating, and you know, you can join up with them and leave together. So.
Yeah, definitely. At the beginning, when everybody's together, of course, you see a lot more people. If you're in a pace group biking, you're with maybe a few people or 6-7 people. But skiing and on foot, you know, once you get past probably 10 to 15 miles, you're kind of, you know, just a little microsecond difference, you know, per you know, 100 yards, and all of a sudden you're kind of on your own.
Yeah.
And, you know, after probably dark, you don't see a snowmobile. Mm-hmm. Unless it's, you know, maybe one person affiliated with the Arrowhead that's out kind of checking. But otherwise, after dark, I mean, you're on your own out there usually.
Yep, for hours.
Are there limits to the race? I maybe should have looked on the website. I know, I think the bike has filled up in the past pretty quick. But, I mean, do they fill up the run and ski, or maybe not ski?
I think they have a total limit on participants my guess. And the cycling is still probably the biggest, then on foot. And then skiing, there's only a handful of people that do it. So, but he caps it at a total number, I think. And, you know, and the checkpoints are still... for, you know, it's a long race, but it's not a 2-week race. But by the time you get to 35 miles and then 70, you know, you're pretty, I'm always pretty happy to see other people just for a change of mental thought, you know, and to maybe warm up slightly. I've done it, they have an unsupported category, which I've done once, where you're not allowed, so to speak, you're not allowed inside. So that was weird too. But most events, most times I've done it, you know, it's kind of cool to go in and talk with a couple other people and then get on your way. I mean, there's pros and cons to that. You lose your rhythm a little bit, but sometimes that's good too, to break whatever mood you were in.
Right. The unsupported always seemed weird to me, because, like, why couldn't you just go out and do it yourself, you know?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a stretch, but I get the intent, and just like any race, I say that with my own events that, you know, a lot of people could do these by themselves, but there's an experience component to doing a race that you can't take away. And that no matter what event, from a charity 5K to a huge world-known race, it is the act of getting together that's that people will pay for, even if they receive very little during the event.
That was just for the t-shirt, but
well, yeah, and that, yeah.
The opportunity to go to the Fortune Bay Casino once a year.
Yeah, exactly.
What do each of you think the biggest challenges? I mean, there's a lot of challenges, like the gear list, and that's something that we haven't talked about. Like, you need this gear. I mean, the conditions, whether it be snow conditions, weather, wind chill, whatever. Is it the desolation and just being in your own mind, or just the sheer brutality of 135 miles? I mean, there's a lot of challenges. What do each of you think is the biggest?
I think it's a different challenge for everybody and every year. Some years the challenge might be just getting the training in. You know, depending on if you foot, ski or bike, the challenge might be in the gear that you use. Definitely it can be in the conditions. You know, if it's 20 below and you're on skis, good luck. I think, you know, a big challenge, of course, is mental. You can have all the physical preparation in the world, but you get out there and it's 35 below and it's 11 o'clock at night on the first night, you know, you still have 36 hours left to go. That can be a big challenge, or if you're, you know, in any way struggling physically or mentally, it's a challenge out there.
Yeah, I mean, the one year that I dropped out, it was my game. My head wasn't in it. I had a daughter that was sick, and she was okay, but I couldn't stay focused, and so I dropped. But that race is so weather dependent, and I swear it can be 60 degrees in Duluth the 3 days before the event, and it will always be 20 below in Niagara Falls. And you just have to be ready to just keep going. And you can spend all your time on gear and all your time on threads talking about gear, which is good. And I've done the same thing. That's how you learn. That's definitely part of the game now. But when it comes down to it, it's just getting to the start line and then keeping at it, you know. And it is. You have to go checkpoint to checkpoint or some other shorter distance because, again, this isn't a race across the country, but it's a long event. And it's for foot and ski. It's going to be you're going to be out overnight. And you have to be comfortable with that. And I think that's where some people find that they kind of have it or they don't. And maybe they'll get to that point too, but you just, that ability to keep going.
Yeah, I guess for me, it's definitely, I don't know, at first I was thinking of it in terms of like physical and mental, but it ended up kind of more being emotional than anything, kind of keeping your wherewithals. And I had some little micro breakdowns for maybe 45 seconds during it where I had to collect myself, where, yeah, it's just stuff hits you, you know, sideways that you just can't anticipate coming once you leave the start line. Because, you know, like these two said, you're out there for so long, you can get into such a great rhythm for a while and just lose it and don't know what caused you to lose that rhythm. And then you got to figure it out, troubleshoot along the way. And but, you know, I think that's why most of us do that, is we want to be challenged, and this event offers that. So,
I mean, can you even train for the mental part, you know, or is that something that you're just kind of born a weirdo or something, you know, for lack of a better term? You know, I mean, I assume doing long, hard races trains you mentally probably better than anything else.
I mean, that's why it took me so long to do this one, because I just felt this to be like, I don't know, the ultimate graduate level race. And I felt, you know, before I decided to finally pull the trigger and sign up, I was like, well, I've done quite a bit of other things that I think I've learned from, you know, all of them collectively. Mm-hmm. And was just hoping it was going to be enough. Fortunately, it did for this year. But, you know, another year could be totally different because, you know, like these two said, you just don't even know what the weather's going to be like. It can change the week up so drastically. And so gear, you kind of pick the best well-rounded gear, and that's about all you can do sometimes.
I think there is an element of trial by fire with some of these, because it's very hard. Most people I know, and I certainly don't anymore, go out and train for 20 hours. I don't have the time. I don't have the interest in doing that anymore, really. And so you kind of have to experience it to see how you're going to do. And I think most people would agree, and I found as well, that that whole thing that you hear, and it's kind of cliche, that you can do more than you think, is is sometimes the case, and sometimes you can't. But on some of these races, your mindset changes in a way that you go deeper than you thought you had or could before. And I don't know of any other way of finding that out than just kind of attempting it. And even not being able to do it as education. I mean, of like finding out that you quit after 50 miles or whatever, 10 miles. You learn from that too, but it's hard to replicate in training. You can certainly get good miles in, but it's very different once you get going.
Yeah, I think it's probably a combination of the races you've done before and having the confidence in going along, whatever you've done. Probably the excitement of doing the race for the first time or second time, or store camp at the 11th or 12th, or and he's like so super excited for this race every year. If you're super excited, as they say, if your purpose is strong enough, there's no such thing as willpower anymore. But then also, I think just kind of you look at your life at the time, and whether it's a kid sick or brother having some issues, or your family or work stress, you can think that you're really excited about it and you put in the training, and all of a sudden you get into it and you're thinking, okay, maybe I need to be somewhere else right now. And so yeah, it's kind of a perfect storm of training and opportunity and excitement and mindset.
Yeah, if you're doing it on foot or skis, you're out there for a long time. Or even a lot of the bikers, too, are out there for a long time. So you're gone from home for, sometimes 4 or 5 days, depending on how early you go up there and come back home. And so it can be a while. It's definitely it has an impact on your daily life, for sure. Before you guys started, was there anything that kind of... when I first heard about Arrowhead, I was flat out scared of it. I just thought that was crazy, especially just the temperatures. The distance was one thing, but the temperatures really freaked me out. Was there anything that kind of, was that part of, did you guys feel those concerns when you first kind of heard about it as well? Shuni, you touched on a little bit, or was it more of an intrigue?
It was both. The first reaction was for sure fear, but the idea that maybe it's possible to overcome that fear. Where there's opportunity for challenge, it's fun to face that. But of course, in this case, you want to be safe along the way. Right. Don't get in over your head, because this is an event. Yeah, I mean, there's, you don't get a second chance sometimes. People with digits, fingers and toes, and
right.
You hate to see that. Just because you're let your ego get out of hand or what have you. But it was both.
I think for a lot of people who hear about Arrowhead, there is that kind of that initial. I don't know. I guess I'll call it fear, for lack of a better term. And I know for me personally, that fear that I fully had and stayed with me for a while before I got involved with the whole deal, that fear was also sort of a motivator too. It was enough of an intrigue and a uniqueness to that kind of fear. Like, what is that all about? How does that feel like to go out there in that kind of temperature for that long? That was, like I say, it was kind of a driver for me instead of a something that held me back, I guess.
Yeah, I think I was a little naive the first year going in. Like I said, that was the year that, we met Charlie Farrow, and, for him, there was no fear. He pretty much could do anything he wanted. And, it doesn't matter how cold or how long, you just kind of push through it, and, you just did it. And that fall, when Jeremy and I and Charlie and Tim Eck, we started riding together, we go out for like 6 to 7, 8 hour rides, and it would be raining or 40 or cold, and we just went, and it was kind of fun, but it was miserable. But I think you just kind of get so used to it. And at the time, I always, as long as I could keep moving, I could keep warm. And Charlie taught us, if your feet get cold, you just get down and you walk for a while, and as long as you keep moving, I think you're pretty good. So probably a little naive at the time, just because of our training.
Ignorance is bliss.
The people that, our teachers can kind of show us the other side.
It was a pretty steep learning curve during that first one with me, with that ignorance is not quite bliss, but it's maybe a safety factor. You get into it and you're like, oh, this is what this is going to look like. And it changed pretty dramatically. It was a cold year that first year I did it. But if you knew it going into it, you would really, really doubt or second guess your sanity a little bit. So the stories add to the intrigue, but again, getting into it, you learn quickly how to adapt or not. And there's not There's not a lot. There's training that can help with that, but again, it gets into that race brain, and you do sometimes dumb things, but it also helps you keep going too.
Jeremy, I think you wrote about this a year or two ago. I remember, I'm pretty sure it was you that wrote this, and I remember reading it and laughing because it was so true. How do you talk about Arrowhead with people who don't do these kinds of things? Co-workers and family members who just aren't involved in anything, even athletic.
It's boy, there's a lot of analogies, but the most typical thing you hear, and I think most would agree with this, and I work at the hospital, which you think there'd be a lot of healthy people out in the hospital, and I'm here to tell you that there's not a lot of healthy people that work at the hospital, but you say, well, I'm going to run 135 miles, and the first thing they say is, I can barely make it to the mailbox. Yeah. And the story always shifts to what your listener can't do.
Yeah.
And I've really keyed in this over the years. I'm like, part of me is like, yeah, I know the answer, but it's this funny mentality that I don't talk about it much. There are some people that are truly interested in that. And even those people are interested, but they don't, it's hard to grasp.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there's slivers, just slivers of, you know, people come back from war or very traumatic situations. Racing a race is not war by any stretch. But it is that idea you've done something that not many people have done. And it's hard to understand what that's like. And so a lot of people can't even get their head around that idea. And it's part of it's comical. And part of it for some people is really, I mean, it can lead to depression post events, just like PTSD can, and other things where you have a hard time getting that experience back into everyday life. And for most people, it's not an issue. They adapt, they get in the swing of things again. But that's the kind of power that some of these races have for people. And, you know, it can be kind of comical, but yeah, a lot of people just can't get their head around it. Why you'd want to do that? That's always a huge question. Why would you want to do that? And it's a very legitimate question. But I've thought many, many, many hours and days on this, and I don't know if I have great answers, but I've just come to the realization that there is part of me and a lot of people that do this that like to pack things up and pull things or carry things. It's like I was born in the wrong century. I should have been doing something. I mean, having Gold a pack on my back or hauling a tire feels good to me. And I work in mental health, and I know that I watch some of our patients wear weighted vests or they wear weighted blankets at night because it makes them feel secure or better. I'm like, I joke that my pack is my weighted vest kind of, you know, I just feel better doing it for a certain number of hours. I don't know about for 3 days, but anyway.
What about Dave and Jason? Have you been asked that question? Why? And how did you answer?
Yeah, I know. I would think I'd be better at answering this by now to coworkers and family. Yeah, I mean, like Jeremy was just saying, I mean, there is something to the simplicity, you know, you hear people talk about. It's just kind of going back to a primal existence almost, you know, I mean, just it's just the necessities in the moment to get from start to finish safely, which is nice, you know. It's a really, really good escape. Yeah, it's a weird way of doing it, but some of us it works. It's a great vacation. I guess I haven't really come up with a really good explanation really either that people might buy.
Well, I mean, do you feel like it's almost a necessity in your life to do these types of things?
I don't know if I wouldn't say necessity.
What if someone told you couldn't race long anymore? Would you be bummed out?
It would certainly be a void in life, absolutely. Yeah, I guess, I mean, when you put it that way, yep.
Yeah, because I've thought about that too. I again work with people, and I know Jason and you do, you're in the hospital as well, of seeing people that physically can't do that anymore. As I get older, I get more appreciative of what I can do. And it may not be why doing this is not good for your body. I joke that sometimes I was healthier when I smoked a pack a day than when I was doing this, you know. But it's still that idea of I really value the fact that I have the ability to, you know. Do you feel that way, Jace?
Yeah, you know, after a number of years, maybe not as much as I did 5 to 10 years ago. But, you know, to come back to, you know, the first question, you know, what do you tell people? probably, I would say either number one, don't tell people because, you know, it's just too hard to explain. Number two, if they ask, you just, you know, try to minimize it as, you know, it's just a race up in northern Minnesota. And, you know, if they really need the details, you can talk about them. But, well, yeah, I guess you just, I don't start the conversation very often. Yeah.
Yeah, but you have to have been asked, like, why would you do something like that, you know? And
yeah, yeah, I don't know. Nothing else to do in northern Minnesota in the middle of winter. I ran out of books.
That's funny.
What do you guys have? What are you, some of your gear / fuel go tos?
That's what I'm really interested in. I'm like a gear nerd. I love hearing about what you do for food. You know, how do you keep your water from freezing? You know, gear. Yeah, the gear list. I mean, maybe let's touch on the gear list that you need. I could pull it up on the website, but
yeah,
maybe you guys want to start just rattling off some of the stuff you need.
Yeah, there's some required gear that you have to carry with you.
Yeah.
So is it a 20 below bag?
Yeah, minus 20 bag, insulated sleeping pad, stove,
baby sack,
yep.
Fire starter,
3,000 calories.
Finished with 3,000 calories. Yep. The insulated
reflective
water
material,
carrier,
yeah.
Reflective gear.
There's a lot of stuff that you have to carry. Overall, probably sleds are around that 30 to 40 pound range.
I would
maybe.
Yeah, I think we could get it under that. Again, some gear's gotten lighter these days, but
true.
I've switched to, I have a 40 below bag now that I kind of just decided to buy, and it is a little bulky. But when the first year I did bivvy out twice actually, and that was tough. So that if you can race it and know that you're not going to spend the night, you can kind of you get the gear, but you know you may not use it. But those that are going to be out multi-day, you better be sure that you know how to use it and that that it might work to keep you warm. So I have upped my game with the sleeping bag, even though I swore I'd never bivvy again, because it is tough to do no matter how much experience you have being out at night in the winter.
Was that because of just like too tight, like sleepy, tired? Or?
Well, you go to, it's you. You know, I remember my heart was racing. I don't think it ever could drop below 120 when I was laying in bed. You were sweaty. Your whole physiology changes when you're out doing this constant pace for 16 hours, and you can't just get your heart rate down to 60 when it's nighty night time, you know. And so it was a miserable night's sleep, and you're shivering and you're cold and your body's just super weird, you know. And so you can go spend the night in your, you know, in your backyard and try something out, but you ramp that up, it changes. And then, you, as another note, you get a lot of people that have never fired up a stove before or never boiled snow or got snow to a liquid state. And I always, there are some events where they mandate that, where you have to stop and boil, turn snow into a quart of water. And it's contrived, but it's kind of fun, too. So that's, you know, I think you have to know how to use the gear that you bring. I think most people don't use the gear that they bring, so that's a kind of a weird thing. You know, there's a Norwegian Birkebeiner, I think, where you just carry a stone or a weighted pack, and you might as well be doing. But there are years when you better know how to use that gear that you bring, whatever it is. So as far as the water bit, I've gone everything from insulated bottles in my sled to, you know, camelbacks or water pouches on your back, and there's heated.
Hydro
heaters and stuff like that. And I still to this day I find myself eating a lot of chocolate chips, and I've read some recipes of what people bring out there, and like, wow, that's really fancy, that sounds great, and I should do that. And I always end up eating junk food at the gas station. But it does pay. You need to know how your body reacts. I see people eating a lot of gummy bears and coffee, and that's a sure recipe for disaster. So basic food works best for me still. And if you got to know that if it freezes at 20, it's got to be edible at 20 below, because Clif Bars will have you wearing dentures by the end of the weekend. So
there's the minimum gear, I think for me, over a couple of years, I tried to go as light as I could on the minimum gear without breaking the bank. I have a 20 below sleeping bag. First one I used was, you know, probably 10 pound. And then I bought like, a $210, probably an REI something. It's a 20 below. It's like probably the cheapest down, but it's still pretty heavy. You could spend an extra $400 and lose another pound or two. I do not have, you know, carbon rims on my fat bike. I just can't justify $1,000 and you get, you know, kids in college, you know, it's still just a race, but, you know, some people that makes, it can make a huge difference if you can do that. You know, skiing and on foot, it's probably not quite as big. If you're wearing a pack, skiing maybe a little bit, you know, just trying to go as light as you can. I definitely went, you know, light on my stove. You know, I've been the Esbit tablets and try to go as light as I could there. And then you just try to use your gear more efficiently. You know, you can have the lightest bike in the world, but if you got 100 pounds of pressure in your tires and the trail is soft, and you know, you're not going to go anywhere. And so you have to know how to ride low tire pressures or high, you know, adjust the pressure in your tires. You know, you have to know, you know, how to use the gear more efficiently. If you plan to, you know, bivvy out, you probably want a different stove than if you're just going to try to ride the bike in 16 hours. You want as light as you can. I use a heavier but more compact sleeping pad if I'm on a bike, just so I can fold it into my sleeping bag. If I'm pulling a sled or if it's in the backpack, I use a really lightweight sleeping pad called a water heater wrap. So, you know, you can play around with the gear a little bit, make it a little bit lighter, but just knowing how to use it more efficiently is probably the biggest thing.
Yeah, I think the fact that there's so many, if you read people's posts and you talk to them about what they use for gear, there's so many different varieties of options and the ways that people go about it just shows right there that there really isn't a one-size-fits-all approach to gear and nutrition for that matter, too. It seems like a lot of different things. I'm with Jeremy, for me, junk food works the best because it tastes the same and it doesn't freeze. I tried bacon, little chunks of bacon one year, and then well, you could sort of gnaw on them. The flavor was horrible when it gets that cold. I don't know what the deal is. So, but like, you know, Cheetos and things work great regardless of the temperature, even though it's bad food.
I think one year I did use a Hammer product, the Perpetuum, and I was using that quite a bit. And I swore to never, not a knock against Hammer, but it just, after that many hours, you just, your gut couldn't take it. Yeah. And it gets back to some basics, and you can spend all your life researching some of the caloric needs and what to do, but then when it comes down to it, not to minimize it, you got to keep eating. I'm religious about drinking and eating about every 15 minutes to half hour something to keep that going. Mm-hmm. But that's the key to me of just continuing to eat and drink. But if you get down, you can't replace, in my understanding of physiology, you really can't replace the calories that you're burning in an event like this. So the goal is to keep a trickle going in and not to get sick to your stomach somehow. So those are probably the biggest aspects that, and then you just switch energy sources to a certain degree while you're doing this, I think.
Yeah, I had the same experience. I think my second Arrowhead on bike, and I got probably to mile 100, and I think the whole race I was using Perpetuum, you know, as my, you know, then I wouldn't have to take my hands off the bars to eat and figure out what's going to be, you know, solid or frozen. And I got to about mile 100 and my stomach just went south and I had like no other food. And that was the last time I used any drink calories for anything, I think, in any race. And just barely kind of trickled into the finish after that.
Yeah, with all the fancy, sorry, Dave, you know, I just use regular water. I don't use electrolyte tabs. I don't really personally believe in them. You can get a lot of that in just basic junk food, to be honest.
Yeah.
Do you use anything, Dave? For
And so with you guys, I just eat junk food. just nothing sports science, I guess, you know, the nutrition at all. And as far as liquid too, I just use water. I just hope I'm getting calorie and whatever other electrolytes in what I'm eating. I'm looking forward to trying the other two disciplines. I wanted to start out on foot first because I figure I got this big sled behind me with this duffel that I can just throw all sorts of options. Mm-hmm. I don't have to worry about weight. Mm-hmm. I definitely wasn't counting the grams by any means.
Yeah.
If I felt it would make me comfortable, I threw it back there and I know I'm dragging it with. So,
mm-hmm.
As far as sleeping bag too, I got a huge bag and I had to use it out there and it was actually very comfortable. I actually got a good mm-hmm. nap in, and I've seen other people with their bags that I just look at them at the start line, I'm like, boy, if you need to use that, is that gonna be enough? It just makes me worried for them.
Well, it seems like it's this whole kind of mixture of your race strategy plus the gear that you plan on using. I mean, like, if you know that you're not gonna bivy, then you don't need that -40 mm-hmm. down bag, but mm-hmm. then if you're in a pinch, then you're probably in a kind of serious situation. And
I think about the bike. I'm looking forward to doing that some year, and I just can't even fully, I mean, I've seen plenty by now, but to load my own bike with everything that I think I might need, that's going to be something.
It's doable. The last time I did the Arrowhead, it was on the unsupported category, and Farrah and I decided to just try that. It was a cold year, the snowmobile trail, which the events on the Arrowhead, the North Shore State Trail, it was very firm for a good chunk of it. And I had 5 liters of water with me, and that carried me through. And so the bike was extremely heavy. It's kind of like pushing a motorcycle. But once you get it rolling, it's amazing with fat bikes, in my experience, or any big tour bike, to be honest. Once you get rolling, things change. We didn't stop. The 5 liters was enough water for me to get through. I didn't have to boil any water. So we got lucky, a little bit of luck. And I had very little when I finished, but I wasn't in dire straits either. So
has that been a strategy for any of you to say, I'm going lighter weight, but in that case, I have to melt snow?
No.
Never.
No.
I'll eat snow, but I won't melt snow.
Yeah. I mean, that takes a lot of time.
The first year I skied, I did stop. I ran out of water past the halfway, and I stopped at one of the shelters just kind of as an icon for where you would stop, and I melted snow. Your reference of time is different. Skiing, I watch some people pass me, but things slow way down, and so a half hour of doing that's not that big, and plus then I had water and I was able to go. Otherwise,
warm
I
water.
Would have been done. I had cocoa and it was great. And but it's like when you're lost, you have to change your brain to be like, oh yeah, I'm lost, I need to do something. And to get to that point to stop is a huge mental hurdle, and I think a lot of people can get into trouble that way, that they're like, I gotta go, I can't stop, and then you're in bad way,
Yeah.
So you
race
have
brain.
To train your brain to get out of that race brain a little bit. I'm like, okay, I can deal with a half hour stop to either shut my eyes or boil snow or something. And it was a very memorable part of the event too, doing that. And that's something that most cyclists don't do on that race. And I wouldn't either if I didn't have to, but the foot and, I mean, the Arrowhead, the foot and the ski categories are almost totally different events than the cycling event because of the duration of time you're on out. So
yeah, I think number one, most people probably drink too much water, more than what they need, so then they feel like they have to carry more. Number two, with the Gateway, if you're doing it supported, you have Gateway at 35 and Mel George's at 72 and the TP at 110.
Mm-hmm.
You should be able to carry enough on you or with you to get to those.
Mm-hmm.
There are actually a couple of areas, even on the coldest of years, you could get water if you wanted, especially after Mel George's. There's some little springs along the way. There's usually an opening in the lake that Mel George's is on right before you cross the lake to get there, that you could even get water. You can eat snow. That's kind of an old wives' tale that, eating snow, that you burn more water than what you get from it. The only bad thing about eating snow is it's going to cool your core temperature down.
Yeah.
So you don't want to do it if you're freezing. Another thing you can do that I've done even is bring a Ziploc, and you just fill it with snow and you put it inside your coat, and especially if you're warm and toasty, and you can melt it, and you don't get a lot of water, but it's enough. You can put it it in your Camelback. But, you know, and you can probably go a couple hours without drinking water, longer than you think, especially if you train your body to do it. And for me, it was always going to take more effort and, you know, potential for bad things happening to actually stop and melt snow to get water than it would be to push through an extra, you know, hour or two. And so I never had any problems at all with water.
Yeah, I definitely didn't try and save grams there either. I toted mine in hydro flasks, which are pretty heavy tanks, but they kept my water warm, actually, from checkpoint to checkpoint, which was really nice. I mean, I could take the cap off when I did want to stop trailside and just to see it steaming. I mean, it was just kind of like it put a smile on my face just knowing it was there waiting. Yeah. Didn't have to struggle with having it in the liquid form ever like some people have had stories.
Simple is I used to run dogs, and simple is the way to go with any, for this event, from zippers to Gore-Tex to fabrics to tie downs to plastic to everything breaks at 20 below and or gets weird at 20 below and everything breaks at 30 below. So if you've got all of a sudden a cap that you can't open on your water bottle because it's frozen, you're in a bad way, and you've got to figure out how to open that cap. So super, like, I wear very basic materials. I happen to use wintergreen materials, which is Supplex, which has been around for 100 years, you know. It just, I know what it's going to do, and I've seen a lot of fancy Gore-Tex ski jackets that people wear fail because they lock up with ice and they've got all these layers. And so whatever it is that you're using for any discipline, make sure that it works at 20 below and that your hands can open it. It's not going to break. And that, yeah, it's funny how that becomes a mantra for me when I'm packing or what I'm eating too, that you can open the wrapper. I mean, that literally those basic things where that you can chew it. It just got to imagine everything looking very weird at 20 below.
I think with Arrowhead and big events in general, but Arrowhead specifically, really more than any that I've experienced before, is there's so much that you have to figure out right there in that moment. It's like the Mike Tyson quote: "Everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth."
Yeah.
You know, there's times at Arrowhead where you like things are now way different than what you thought they were going to be like, and you have to figure some stuff out. And I know it gets overplayed a little bit. Maybe it's not entirely life-saving sort of things in the grand scheme of things, but it is still important, and it could be potentially dangerous if you don't get it figured out. So I think Arrowhead definitely brings that out for sure.
Yeah. I think we're so lucky up here in Duluth that, you know, we have winter for a little bit longer than the cities. We can, you know, I can pull a sled, bike, or run from my house to trails and be out for, you know, hours and hours. So you can specifically train for whatever, either, not really distance, but whatever, you know, if you're going to bike it or ski it or on foot. You know, you try to be really efficient and think about it. You know, you plan ahead so you know how to use all your gear. Like my water, it doesn't matter what discipline I'm doing, I always wear 110-ounce Camelback underneath my coat. I don't put any water in, you know, any other, like on my bike, inside my frame bag or in my sled. I'm just afraid it's gonna freeze. And then you learn how to use it on your back too. If you have I had one time during the Arrowhead, I had my hose exposed on my neck, and it was 20 below and it froze, and I kind of freaked out, and but, you know, stopped and stuck it in my armpit, and it thawed out, and then I was fine. And after that, you learn how to, you know, blow back, and all you have to do is get that water out of there and it should be fine. You watch some of the Alaskans, they used to come down a lot, and you watch, you know, how they do it, and you know, they blow back, or they just kind of, you know, grab their hose and they hold it above their head and pinch the nozzle so it all flows back in. And so you learn things from other people, or you learn them out on your training, and so you kind of know how to use your gear, and you train for it, and you practice for what you're going to do out there.
Yeah, totally. You do the melting snow thing. You go out, and you maybe, like, when I bought my bivy and my sleeping pad and my bag, I went and I slept on my deck, you know, in the winter time, just to practice that and set it all up at night and go out and ride your bike or run on the trails at night, on the snowmobile trails on a weeknight when there's nobody out there, and do all that kind of stuff.
What about sleeping? How do you deal with sleep deprivation? I mean, especially on the ski or the run, like, that's an issue. Do you have a strategy? I mean, like, do you sleep every 3 hours, or just wait till the checkpoints and zonk out, or Or here's another question, especially with this water and like getting out of the race brain and making the decision to stop. And Jeremy, you kind of mentioned this. If you have slept on the trail, you know, is it just because you're sleepy? Is it because you just feel bad? You need to take a rest? I mean, what prompts that decision to say, I'm getting my gear out, I'm bunking down, you know?
I slept at Mel George, which yeah, didn't require gear because you get to sleep in a cedar lodge. but I slept at Surly, which is the third checkpoint too. And I wanted to wait till I got to a checkpoint, I guess. Just, I don't know, comfort of being around the staff that's involved with the race and other racers too. For me, it's just if I need like even summertime ultras, I've just gone down and leaned up against the trunk of a tree in between aid stations, you know, just because I was too tired. It is based on tired. But for me, I try and get to a checkpoint though if I'm going to sleep, if I can. But if I can't, yeah, I pull it up because it's required in the moment. I mean, you get so inefficient so fast. I realize when you're that tired that it's not worth it, and I just need to take it now. So,
I've done both. I've pushed through and paid the penalty as far as hallucinating. And then I've also stopped and bivvied. And that's tough, too. There isn't a great answer. The last year I ran it, I slept for probably 45 minutes total in the 43 hours I was out. And I was down to sleepwalking, I think, with about the last 15 to 20 miles to go. And it was a super cold year. I think it was 30, 40 below or whatever coming through that bog. And then I woke up and I just started the string of profanity to wake up. And then I started jogging again. And I was all like, wow, you're going twice as fast as you were already, you know. But the sleep, I hallucinated pretty badly on that trail, just seeing things out in the trees. And then so like, don't look out in the woods, you know, just stay focused. And I should have stopped and slept for at least 45 minutes. Even 15, 20 minutes can reset the brain. Yeah. And if you feel probably comfortable enough in your gear to be like, okay, I'm going to stop. It's fine. I'm going to just shut my brain off for a little bit. You can recharge your brain. I think there's a lot of studies on that it can keep you much safer. It just totally depends. I've run some years where I slept for about the same and I felt good. I ran, you know, the last 20 miles and it was a real race, you know. My brain was kind of on. It was very surreal getting back to. No matter how good you feel, you finish your race at the casino, which it used to be, and it's like, it was like a weird sort of drug trip going into that place. But knowing that it's okay to stop and sleep again is sleepiness, because on the bike I've crashed from just falling asleep. I've slept walk. I mean, at some point you either break through or you try to eat, and a lot of sugar doesn't do it. I don't know a way to push through that.
Caffeine?
Other than to stop. And I don't use caffeine either because my heart gets weird with caffeine. So, yeah. What do you think?
For the Arrowhead, I never planned on sleeping on any of them. My plan was to push through, that it wasn't going to take that long that I would have to sleep. The bike, the first couple of years I biked it, and that was no problem because, you know, I didn't go over, I don't think, 20, 21 hours or so. The first year I did it on foot, I made it to 36 hours, and just my mind blew out on me. I hit the hallucination stage, but I was within sight of the big glow from the casino in the finish, and so I could push through the last couple hours. But I was really hallucinating badly, and I mean, I was even, you know, thinking that, you know, Preyman was the race director, and I was having these thoughts like, Preyman's gonna get all mad because, you know, I went crazy and, you know, passed out and died out there. And I did one year in at Tuscobia, I did the same thing. I made it to 38 hours, and I was, you know, probably 8 miles from the finish, and I couldn't do it. I thought I was going to die. You know, I was starting to have these weird thoughts that I was dying, and, you know, mad that I did that to my kids and my wife. And I actually pulled out my sleeping bag and, you know, got just off the edge of the trail and jumped in. I don't even know if I slept. I just remember like breathing really hard for like 45 minutes, and then I was fine. And I got up and kind of finished, but I had to go really slowly after that. Otherwise, yeah, my heart rates were going really high. Huh. One year, actually, I did bivvy once on the Arrowhead. I didn't plan on it. It was the year that I skied it, and I got about an hour or two, probably 1:32 in the morning, and I was past Mel George's, and you get into really big hills. And I was tired enough, and I was starting to get scared going down the hills. I was wearing a backpack and skis, and I'm not a very good skier. And it was starting to get scary going down the hills. So at the top of one hill, and I forget, there's a little bivvy, like a three-side. On the Arrowhead Trail, they have these three-sided little, I don't know, cabins or Andrew shelters.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I forget the name of the shelter. It's about an, it's about an hour and a half.
Elbow Lake?
It's probably, what, 10 miles past Melville.
Yeah, just, yeah, then that's where.
And right on the top of this big hill. I pulled off into there and got in my sleeping bag. And it was probably 20 degrees out, and it was so comfy. And just closed my eyes, and I could hear these people going by on their bikes. And, you know, I probably slept for 3 hours, and three or four other people joined me in there. And then I, when I got up, it was probably 5:36 in the morning, and I was refreshed enough that then, you know, it was safe for me to go down the hills again. But yeah. But I didn't plan on bivvying, but it was kind of nice and fun. And But, yeah, that was, yeah.
For me, it's always the second night. The first night is plugged through that relatively easy. I typically, the 2 years that I've finished, I've slept at Mel George just because.
Yeah.
Well, it's warm, it's here, I'm going to sleep. And even though Mel George has got its own little kind of negative vibe sometimes, and you're in there, it's super crowded, and a lot of people are kind of like, what in the heck have I just gotten into?
Yeah.
That kind of death stare that happens out there. But this the second night, and I've always bivvied at Surly at the checkpoint there. But the last year that I did it, I was getting so tired in between Mel George and that third checkpoint that I just laid down on my sled on the trail and fell asleep on purpose. Because I'd read where, well, you can kind of, you'll just shiver yourself awake. So I'm like, okay, well, I'll probably just sleep for like 20 minutes on this, because I couldn't make it to Surly. And I was like, just laid down. And sure enough, that's exactly what I did. I was just like, woke up shivering. I'm like, oh, I'm awake now.
Shiver bivvy.
Kept on rolling. But I didn't bother getting out my sleeping bag and the bivvy and all that stuff. I was like, I'm just going to lay on my sled. It worked out pretty well, actually.
Yeah. I'm getting scared talking about this.
Well,
wait, I got
yes.
One last question.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, you can only do one word answer. And that's, what's the best mode of transport? Is it foot, ski, or bike?
Oh, man.
Period. What's the best mode?
Well, I can't speak on it yet because I've only done foot. So I gotta say foot.
All.
Oh.
Yeah, nice. More than one word. They're all different. You know, biking. And it all depends. Are you racing? Are you trying to finish it? You know, racing bike can be really, really hard. On foot, it's you don't get the benefit of any glide downhill. You gotta step it every time. I mean, some people ride their sleds downhill. I never did that, but foot is very, very rewarding. It's great being out there for, you know, that long and doing something like that. Ski, you know, it's tough going up those hills and your arms and legs if you're not a very good skier. But at least you get a little glide going downhill. Every little hill, you know, you're gliding along and you're kind of taking a little rest on your knees. And they're all good.
Some free miles.
The bike doesn't, you know, if you're decent enough, it won't take as long. But I feel like that gets underrated for toughness because, well, you still have to ride a bike.
Yeah.
So you're out there and you're dead tired and you've got all that gear on there and you still have to ride the bike. And that, I mean, it's walking is walking.
Mm-hmm.
I've been, you know, been doing that for 48 years. It's just walking. It's not a big deal. But biking is really underrated in how tough it is. It seems like it would be the easiest because you're done in 20 hours or however fast, you know, those guys are. But, yeah, it's because then you're pushing a bike, and that's no fun. That's
uphill on bike is the hardest, and your feet are, it's really, for me, it's tough to keep them warm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're walking and skiing a little bit easier. Yeah.
There is no, people ask that a lot, too, of like, what's the best way to go? And there is no best way to go. Every one of them has pros and cons that are very serious. You're out longer. Or you're done faster, but your cycling can be cold on certain parts. If it's fast, it's almost certainly very cold. The trail is really packed down, but then it's super cold, and you got to deal with cold injuries. And if it's warm, you're like, oh, great, I'm not. But then the trail's soft, and then you get wet easier. I mean, there's no easy answer to any of them.
Mm-hmm.
I've stopped that question because they're all difficult in their own way. And they're all rewarding in their own way, too. So it's a lame answer, but it's, in my opinion, kind of the truth. There's just, they're all three different categories with that.
And you can decide on race day morning what distance you're going to, or what event you're going to do if you want. If you're that strong of an athlete, and you can say, well, declare yourself as going on foot, but then decide, you know what, I'm going to bike it instead.
I'm
going
to haul a bike and skis this year and then do a triathlon, and I'm going to try to swim as well somewhere too, to up the game.
All right, I thought about, you know, you could probably... You might be able to bike it and ski it in the same year and still get in under the time.
Yeah.
If you bike, get a ride back to the start, and then ski the rest of the year, you can still get in under 60 hours.
You're a sick man.
My last question then is, and this will hopefully then end on a little more positive note, less scary note, would be, for me, Arrowhead is one of maybe two races that I've truly felt like just an honor to be at. There's something really special and unique about that race, the people that put it on, Ken and all the volunteers, and then the racers themselves. What are your guys' kind of positive thoughts on Arrowhead?
What makes it special?
Yeah.
First year that I did it, it's just crazy. You kind of show up and you're this rookie, and you look around at all these people that, you know, you're in this company of just kind of the, I don't know, toughest of the toughest or the weirdest of the weird. But it's a pretty special crowd, and that first year you're just so kind of conscious of that, and it's kind of a scary thing. And then, you know, a couple years into it, all of a sudden you're kind of part of that crowd. And then, you know, especially when we got into it, it was a little, you know, kind of early, not the, you know, like Pharaoh and that, but, you know, when you get up there in those 5, 6, and 7 finishes, and you know, you kind of see the same people that you've seen at all these other races, and it's been 5, 6, 8 years, and I think that's kind of the big thing, is just, you know, the people that are doing it, you know, it's not like going to a, you know, a 5K or a half marathon where, you know, you have millions of people. You know, I think you kind of get used to it maybe a little after a while, but when you step back and think about it, it's a pretty special race and a special group of people and a lot of good friends, and yeah, it's kind of fun.
I was going to say the same exact thing that Jason just stated, just the community. And I think I remember telling Tony this, just when we did the pre-race briefing the night before, that briefing is like no other that I've sat through. I mean, you can just feel the rookie tension, which I was, and you can see the calm in all the veterans that you're sitting amongst too. And it's just, but it was just a great ambiance in the air. I mean, just that you could just feel it though. So yeah, and it is, it's a very niche group of people. So yeah, it's not the big masses like, you know, a half marathon or marathon. In any big city metro area, but that's what's so special to me, is it it just exudes us being a special event in all ways.
It's hard to, you know, some of these events are so hard that you like, what's wrong with me that I come back after finishing it once? That should be enough. And back to a couple of weird negative, I mean, this group of people, they're an odd bunch in that, you know, some of them are not the most socially capable people, and they're like all grouped together in one room trying to be social the night before, and we're all super nervous still, no matter how many times you've done it, and it's like, okay, awkward. But everyone's right, they're a very nice group of people. The organization is really well done, and it's still unique. Every year is different. Every year is totally different, no matter how many times you've done it, and you never take it lightly. And it is going, I see some of these people once or twice a year, and that's it. And it is really nice to catch up and know that there's other odd types like me out there, and that we can be social for at least a couple hours. And then, but just, it's finishing something like that is no joke. Even after you've done it a few times, I still take it very seriously. And there's not many things in life like that, where it's the whole deal, emotional, physical, and an event, you know, so that's, it's pretty special that way.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks guys for joining us on the podcast, talking a little Arrowhead. It's coming up. What's the date this year? 27th.
Yeah. 27th
of January.
So all three of you are registered, huh?
I am not.
No, Jason.
Not.
I just assumed
it's my winner off.
You're not going this year?
No, I'm not
taking the time off.
Yeah.
Are you going to go up at all?
Probably not. I don't have any vacation time. Okay. No, this year I just needed it. I've done, you know, winter races for, I think, 10 years in a row and, you know, races for 20, and I just needed, you know, a winter off of just kind of playing around, and, which was a good thing. I wiped down on my mountain bike about the middle of November. Broke a few ribs, and the training's been a little shy, so it's probably was fortunate or lucky, but now talking about it makes me all excited.
Got an itch again.
Could sit here and talk for hours. It's like we barely even touched on some of the stories.
Right, exactly.
We could talk for another hour.
Easy.
Especially like the nitty gritty details. Yeah, we could talk for another hour, but
just Pharaoh stories.
Yeah. That would be fun in and of itself. Yeah, thanks for
thanks.
Talk about this.
Good luck to all everybody else who's doing it this year.
Yeah.
And thinking about signing up.
Yeah.
Definitely give it a try.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right, and that wraps up episode number 14 of the Duluth Rundown podcast. We'll call this one the Arrowhead episodes. Speaking a lot about the Arrowhead 135 that's coming up here in about 3 weeks. Thanks to Dave and Jeremy and Jason for coming down and talking about their experiences at the race. And hopefully you listeners enjoyed that one. You know, when Arrowhead happens, follow along. You can follow along online for people who are wearing their GPS trackers, which is kind of fun to do.
Fun couple days to track people.
And it is. It's amazing. You go to bed and then you come wake up the next morning and they're still out there.
Still moving.
It's so crazy to think about. But, yeah, hopefully you all enjoyed that, and we'll see you out there on the roads and the trails.
Enjoy the trails. See you next time.